Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 13, delivered on October 6, 2010. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 1.
Today, review for Exam 1. Four parts. Part 1, multiple choice, 10 questions. Part 2, matching. Part 3, workout problems. No partial credit. You're right or you're wrong. And part 4, written answers. Now let me go back through the grinder and talk to you about each part. The first part is multiple choice. Interestingly, most people find that to be the most difficult, one of the more difficult parts of the exam. Because that's where there is a free-for-all, where I can ask about anything. It could be quantitative questions. Well, which of these is the right number for the problem? Or it could be a definition or a concept. One thing in this class, and I do it deliberately, is I will just throw terms at you and give you a definition of it, and then I just move on. I'm doing that because that's how it's going to work for you in the real world. You're going to hear words and terms, and only once will it be explained to you, and then someone will be exasperated when you don't remember it 10 years later. So that's something that will happen in this exam. What do I mean when I say that this company's annual reports were filed by the SEC? What form would that be on? What would a form be that would report, for example, a non-recurring event? Where would you go in the Edgar system if you wanted unaudited quarterly reports? What form would you look for there? On the other hand, I could say, well, I have a discount treasury bill that's selling at 98.12. What's the yield on it? And then give you four or five possible yields for it. I could also do something like, which of the following is not a tool of monetary policy? Those are the kinds of questions that are multiple choice bait. They can also show up in essays, too. So be aware that there is some overlap there in what you would be studying. Also, in the multiple choice part, it would be possible for me to test you on your knowledge even of things like ratios. Not a definition. Well, which of the following is inventory turnover? No, not like that. I could say, which of the following would you never see? An ROE that was greater than 1, a times interest earned that was less than 1.0, something like that. I could test to see if you understand what these formulas are saying to us and what couldn't happen, so that if you ever got a number like that, you'd know that you made a mistake. So in the multiple choice section, you have a lot more open-ended studying to do, and that is 30% of the exam. Now, in the matching, I trivialize it. I say, well, that's easy. And for most of you, it will be, but don't trifle with the study for it, because there's where I can put in, well, on the one side, I could put in a formula. On the other side, I could put the name of the formula. So that's just an obvious match. But there's also things that I could put there, like a number, just a number. And on the other side, there's a description of something that would be that number, 12. Is there any place in this class course so far where I've used the number 12 other than as months? Don't say, oh, you use that for months. Is there any place where the number 12 has come up in this class? Huh? Say it. No, open it. Yes. Oh, my goodness. You get a cookie. I don't have any, but someone will give you one, okay? Really. Yeah. I mean, something odd like that could show up. These are random factoids, but in a class like this, they have meaning and substance. So the matching part it will carry some things that are very straightforward, but don't just say, well, I don't need to worry about that. Keep your eye on definitions and descriptions. The Federal Reserve, I do want you to know about it. I had you read an article that I wrote about it in which I laid out the basics. You saw a video that I had assigned about the Federal Reserve System. So certainly there is latitude for me to ask questions about the Federal Reserve, because in finance, the Fed's actions make us really nervous, make us pay attention all the time. Right now, the Federal Reserve is signaling that it is still going to do asset purchases, which is a fancy way of saying that it's still going to finance the federal government's debt, because it's scared to death that we are about to drop into a secondary recession. What would that mean as the Fed buys securities? What is the effect of that on interest rates, on securities prices, and on interest rates? The workout section. One of the problems, I will give you all of the information on the website. It will appear on Saturday evening. One of the questions. I'm not saying which question it will be, but I would expect, if I were you, to see something that has to do with probabilities and the economic activity and the resulting sales and other financial information of a firm. I'm not saying that's what it's going to be. I'm not saying that's not what it's going to be. I'm not saying, okay? Now, work out. Well, actually, I could just project the exam here up on the overhead for you to look at for a few minutes. No, I won't do that. I will put up on the exam, you will have an appendix that is a set of financial statements. And I will ask you for some ratios. Straight up, promise you that. I'll ask you for some ratios. Know the right formulas, especially the one that you erred on, many of you did, on the quiz. That is the one that has to do with debt. Make sure that you see if there are any notes payable. Make sure. Because as I have told some of you, I am seeing firms that are going intermediate. They're not going long on debt. They're playing off, pulling that long-term debt up into the intermediate-term debt lines. And therefore, if you don't include notes payable, you are missing the total leverage the firm is utilizing. I will also obviously ask you about volatilities. Know your volatility formulas. Know what business risk is. Know how operating leverage contributes to business risk. Is financial leverage part of business risk? Tell me that. Is financial leverage part of business risk? Up or down? Yes or no? It's that easy. What is it? Is fin- say it? No. He says, no. No, business risk is the risk before that is inherent to your business, to the volatility of your customers' wants for your product, wants and needs for your product and ability to pay, to your choice of capital, of inventory and all that kind of stuff. Fixed expenses versus variable expenses. Financial leverage is your capital structure choice. And that comes after the operating income line. The contribution of financial leverage comes as an addition to business risk, an addition that the company chooses as a result of its capital structure and the resultant interest expenses, which are fixed on the firm. So business risk includes your core of volatility from sales and variable expenses, which don't create any more volatility, and also includes operating leverage, the contribution of fixed expenses. And then once that is determined at the operating income line, your business risk, then comes your financial leverage, the contribution of financial leverage to the risk overall of the company. I will then in some way I will ask you about the capital asset pricing model in a technical way. R sub F plus beta of the security times the R sub M minus R sub F. In some way I will ask about that, possibly embedded in another question. But I will then conclude with a couple of questions about present values, what we have just gone through. Basic questions, I'll have you calculate the present value of a lump sum and or an annuity. I will have you calculate an effective yield. And I will have you calculate a payment. Remember I showed you how to do that. It's a calculator exercise, no more, no less. I will then have you calculate the price of a stock from information about the current dividend and the growth of the expected growth of the dividend. Calculate the current price of a stock from the current dividend and the expected growth rate of the dividend. What I showed you last time. It is an exercise in a constant growth perpetuity. I will not make the present value problems impossibly difficult, which is easy to do with annuities. I will not deal with some kinds of annuities. I will not probe future value of annuity. I'll do that on the second exam. And complex cash flows, I'll do a little of it, but I'm never going to ask you some ridiculously difficult questions. But for now, no present value of a lump sum, present value of an annuity, and also make sure that you know about perpetuities, both level and constant growth perpetuities. The end of the exam is five questions, problems, where I ask you for a one-sentence answer. You choose four of those five. You direct me specifically to the four you want answered. Don't just give me five answers and I'll give you the best points for the four that are the highest score. You give me four answers. If you give me five, I'll grade the first four. Now, technically, it is one sentence and it's a complete sentence. If you don't give me a complete sentence, if you give me grammatical errors, then I will take off for those. That's the way it is. And from there, you need to give me a crisp, precise answer. One sentence will do it. In several of the questions, it will be a short sentence. When I give you the answer that I wanted, when we review the exam, you'll say, is that all there was to the answer? And I'll say, yes. And the questions could be all across the board. And as I said before, look back and think about the questions that could be in the multiple choice part, because this is the second round of that in some ways. What is the relationship between expected return and risk? What do I mean by non-diversifiable risk? How do you distinguish between non-diversifiable and diversifiable risk? By the way, another word for non-diversifiable risk is systematic risk, because it's in the system. What do I mean when I say risk premia in a stock or a bond interest rate? In a bond interest rate. What are the risk premia? How are they different for different instruments? What's an open market operation? How would the Federal Reserve expand the money supply? What does price to earnings ratio mean? Remember, I asked you about that before. I could revisit that. And that's something to also pay attention to. Look at your quizzes. Because those quizzes, I intend those to be review for you for the exam. And by the way, I'll put up a key to this quiz that you're turning in. I'll put up the key to it tonight. As far as other matters go, what is a beta of a stock measure? Specifically, what does beta measure? Does it measure risk? Is that enough to say beta measures risk? No. It measures a specific kind of risk in a specific kind of way. What are the three tools of monetary policy? What is the relationship between the price of a security and the interest rate implied? All other things being equal. What do I mean when I say effective yield? Why would the current ratio matter to me as a financial analyst? What do I mean by residual claim? Who has residual claim to the cash flows? Why is it residual? Why the word residual? Is that enough questions to keep you busy for a while? I'm taking you back on a long, happy walk through this semester. Sometimes when you look at a course like this, it seems almost like a blur. Well, what really happened the last 6-7 weeks? This is your chance to see that a lot was poured at you. And in many ways, let me, and I've said this before, I work with the textbook, but I don't do everything in the textbook. If it's in the textbook and I have said it, then it is definitely fair game. If I have said it and it is not in the textbook, it is definitely fair game. If it's in the textbook and I have not said it, it is not fair game. Okay? So there's not going to be anything on that test that was in the textbook that I did not teach you. Why? Because I'm better than the textbook. And I want you to ask me questions and make them specific. Don't do something like, why am I here? What's my purpose? Okay, go.
Can you see we have a note card?
Yes, 4x6 note card. Yes, front and back. I'm not going to go around turning your damn cards over. And you bring a pencil, okay, for God's sake. I have maybe 20, 30. I can't bring 180. Okay, bring a pencil. Yeah. Okay, price earnings ratio. That is the price that investors are willing and able to pay now for $1 of residual earnings claim from the last reporting period. In other words, for every dollar that the common stockholders could claim at the bottom line of the last reporting period, this is how many dollars investors are paying now for that. So, if I told you that the price-earnings ratio was 32, that would mean that investors right now are paying $32 for a claim on $1 of the company's earnings at the end of the last reporting period. And that sounds obscene, but that would not be a surprising number. Ah, I almost heard something I care about. Boy. Oh. Good thing I already had some Jack in this coffee. I thought something was wrong. Where the hell was I? Okay. For those of you in the podcasting audience, I just made an ass of myself sitting on the edge of a table that nearly flipped and killed me. I have people from around the world listen to these podcasts, God knows why, and they'll actually send me questions. What happened when you went that? That was me barfing because I'd eaten Denny's. Get off it. Yeah. Is that good enough? Okay, what else? Go. What's the Edgar system? It is the Securities and Exchange Commission's system by which it collects and then publishes the financial information of public corporations as required by the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, as amended. So just put it in a nutshell, it's the SEC system for collecting and distributing financial information of public corporations. Now, something... I wish you guys had had me for Business 100 because I drag you down there and I show everyone the Edgar system. It is actually really cool. You go all over the place looking for information about companies. It's all right there in one place in the Edgar system. If I had a chance, I wish there was some way I could do that here. I might have to do it anyway in the second half of this course, show it up on the board here, but that's not like getting your hands on it. But also, as far as the Edgar system goes, I'm going to throw just some terms while I'm feeling beneficent and I'm still off my game from nearly breaking my ass. 10K, 10Q, 8K. AR, what is an AR? What would a slash A after a K or Q mean? Can you tell me that one? What would a slash A? Amended. But know those kinds of terms like the 10K, 10Q, 8K. The AR, no, I didn't mention the AR. The AR is the annual report. It's every company's, public company's annual report. It's right there in the Edgar system, blinking at you. Read me. Now, in the old days, just as a quick aside, when I was an Edgar filing agent, I swear to God, as long as you did the technical structure of the Edgar filing right, with the tags all set right, I mean, you could put in there blah, 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 and it seemed like no one cared back in the day. I mean, it was just like, I don't want to overstate it, but it was just like, no one looked at those. These days, they are more substantive, they are more revealing than they used to be. Now, you remember I mentioned it very briefly, something in the 10Ks. That's really useful. The MD&A. Do you remember I mentioned that just once, I think it was. Do you remember what it was? The management discussion and analysis. Management discussion and analysis. It's a really revealing thing. Oh, I was about to bring that up. That's not the notes. That was the other thing I was about to bring up. What's the financial statement that no one ever talks about that has so much information in it? That's the notes to the financial statement. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Is there going to be a company tax problem on
the internet? No. Not in the... Oh, I'm sorry, as a workout. In the multiple choice section, there could very well be something about taxes. And I could give you something that's a very simple tax problem, but not in the workout section. I'm sorry, I stated that too categorically. But do make sure you know about different kinds of taxes and also know how to calculate a tax from a couple of tiers. That's more something that I would do in the multiple choice section. What else? I had a couple other hands up. Say it.
Residual claim.
When a company, the question was about residual claim. Remember the fundamental accounting equation. Do you remember that? Are you an accounting major?
No.
Good, good. No. But remember, total assets equals total liabilities plus owner's equity. There's a wall of separation between the management and the ownership of a corporation. Here I'm giving you some more information you should know for the exam, anyway, that I brought up. There's a wall of separation between the corporation and the liabilities of a corporation and the owners. That's what makes it so that corporations are such powerful animals, because they bear their own risk because they are their own legal entities. Now, the downside of that, of course, is that the owners should not be interfering in decisions of the management, because they are de facto piercing the corporate veil in that way. But that aside, when a corporation takes its establishes its total assets by a combination of equity and debt, it first must satisfy the debts of the debts that it owes in a timely manner according to the contracts under which those debts were incurred. That means that it pays off its bills, it makes its payments, and it retires its debts in the manner set forth in the covenants of the several debts. Only when it has accomplished these goals to the satisfaction of the debt holders may the corporation then turn and say, the remainder is yours, shareholders. But they are not, the shareholders are not going to get that money as a check. It is the discretion of management whether to declare a dividend or not. So that's why the shareholders have a residual claim on net on the money. They have a residual claim on the net income. They don't get it, but they can claim it. But it is management's decision as to how that money will then be used, whether it will be distributed to the shareholders or plowed back into the corporation. Because if it's distributed to the shareholders realize their claim as cash. If it's plowed back into the corporation, theoretically, the shareholders realize their claim through growth of the corporation, and therefore future growth of the claim. So in other words, the debt holders have the first claim, the prior claim. And only after they have been satisfied in a timely manner, according to the covenants they worked out with the corporation, only then, and that's represented at the net income line, can the shareholders say, this money belongs to us as a claim. Not as an actual money, but as a claim. That's why retained earnings is a myth, as a real object. There is no such thing as retained earnings as a bank account. It is merely a symbolic representation of the accumulation of the residual claims that the shareholders have. Was that long-winded enough for you? Good. But that's fair game. That's good stuff early in the course. And in that same regard, remember, there are different ways that businesses can organize. Now, I won't go through all of those, but certainly you should know the difference between a proprietorship and a corporation. What is the difference, principally, between a sole proprietorship or a general partnership and a corporation? You should know that. And I've actually pretty much said it, at least half of it, in the narrative I gave you just a minute ago. Also, I want you to go back to the early part of the course. Those first few days, back when we were young, we were in love. The future was bright in front of us. That was, of course, before you found out this sucks real bad. Remember I talked about things like financial intermediation. Know what that means. That's so a quick essay question. What surplus economic unit, deficit economic unit? What is a bank?
those kinds of things. Now, the book goes into real detail on different kinds of financial intermediaries. I want you to know the difference between a capital market and a money market. I want you to know that. Read it in the book. That's something I just touched upon, and I want you to go back, and I want you to know what the difference is between a money market and a capital market. Where would you see commercial paper? Would you see that in a money market? Is that a money market term or a capital market term? Say it. Mumble at me. Money market. Because it's such a short-term instrument. It's money market. Capital markets, primary markets, secondary markets, money markets, capital markets. Those kinds of things. I'll go into that in a lot more detail in the second part of this course. I'll take you through the idea of underwriting processes, which was what I did when I owned a penny stock house, all that kind of good stuff. But for now, I do want you to know the difference between a money market and a capital market. Yeah. Opportunity cost. Oh, God, yes. That's something that I really expect you to get tattooed on your ass at the tat parlor across the street. Really. You know, or if you're going to get gauges, have micro print on the gauges defining opportunity costs. That would be very cool. Creep the hell out of other people. That opportunity cost. And in that same regard, what distinguishes finance from accounting? Remember, the book and I both described finance as a confluence of two fields. What's the other field that finance is about? It uses accounting information, but it's not all about accounting, because accounting uses historical costs by necessity, by the rules of the discipline, of the profession. It uses historical costs, but we cannot in economic finance, in the economics of finance, and that's the second discipline, look only at historical cost. We have to look at what's going to happen, what we expect to happen, not at what has happened. I'm glad you brought up that, the cost thing. And remember, there was another cost. There was opportunity cost, there was economic cost, there was, remember, sunk cost, and what is that? What's the meaning of that? Is it important in finance? Are sunk costs relevant in a financial analyst's mind? The answer to that is a resounding. That wasn't resounding. Sunk costs. Are they meaningful in financial analysis? If I've spent $16 million on a project and I'm trying to decide whether I'm going to spend $4 million more, do I make my decision on whether to spend $4 million more based upon $20 million, $16 million, or $4 million? Tell me that. Four. The $16 million is sunk, gone, dead. It's with Jesus now. It has no meaning in finance. That's the sunk cost fallacy, the belief that previous expenditures are relevant to current investment decisions. Well, I spent $100 on that stock 2 years ago, and I'm going to hold it until it gets back to 200, to 100. Well, where is it now? Well, it's at about 5. Where's that 100? It's in that stock. Really? Can you sell the stock for $100? Well, no, I can sell it for 5 now. So your opportunity cost of that stock is not 100, it's $5. You're giving up a cheeseburger and maybe some fries and a shake by holding it. You're not giving up $100. $100 doesn't exist anymore. You decide on whether you're going to buy, hold, or sell based upon future expectations, not on what happened, not in the past. What else? Go.
Can you explain effective yield?
Effective yield. I'll even write the formula for you. Okay, I'm going to write this a little bit differently. This is the way I actually, with You folks, I've been using a little bit more compact formula, and I'm going to expand the way I write it as a teacher of business math. And also in other sections of finance, I tend to be more expansive. Here is the way I would do it most of the time, which I didn't do with you. Let R equal the annual interest rate and D equal the number of compoundings per year. Now this is in this one I'm actually breaking out. Usually when I'm writing the R for you, it's the periodic interest rate. But here, just take your annual interest rate and follow my formula. Don't use this anyplace else, but you would write the effective yield equals 1 plus R over D to the D power minus 1, and then you times it by 100% to get it as a percentage. So I'll write a problem here. What is the effective yield for a savings account that pays 6.5% interest compounded monthly? I'm going to show you how to use this formula here. Okay. There we go. Got it. Okay. Using the formula here, the R is going to be 0.065, and the D will be 12. That's all you need to do to use this fast formula. So that what you'll get is the effective yield would then be 1 plus R, 0.065, over D, 12, all to the 12th power, minus 1, and then times the whole mess by 100% once you get the answer, just to get a percentage. I know none of you would accidentally make a mistake turning things into percentages, but... And if you pump that thing out, and you need to do this too, make sure that you can do it. Because I will ask you for an effective yield on the exam. I promise you, I will ask you for one. So, if I were to do this, 1 plus 0.065 divided by 12, close the parentheses, to the 12th power, minus 1 times 100, 6.70%. There's your answer. Consistent with a lot of other calculation-based results, you should be able to do sort of a sanity check. Is this answer in the realm of possibility? The effective yield will be slightly more, possibly noticeably more, not wildly more, but it will be more than the stated annual interest rate. That was the whole point of why compounding was started in the old days, was to get around a price ceiling on interest rates. So the compounding should bump the interest rate up. And here, sure enough, it takes it from 6.5% to 6.70%. The effective yield allows you to use that 6.70% instead of the more complex periods and interest rate divided by the number of periods and all of that in calculations. So, for example, you invest $2,500 in an account that pays 6.5% compounded monthly. By the way, I think I said present value is only, I can ask you for a future value of a lump sum. I can ask you for a future value of a lump sum on the exam. I wouldn't ask you for the future value of an annuity, but I could ask you for a future value of a lump sum. How much will be in the account in 8 years? Now remember the future value formula. FV equals the present value times 1 plus the periodic interest rate to the number of periods. Now we're back to the normal periodic interest rate number of periods. Here's the thing. Straight up, I can do it by that formula right there. I can say that R is 0.065 divided by 12, and the number of periods is 8 times 12. So that I can do it as the future value. Let me write up here. You can't see behind that stupid island. The future value equals $2,500 times 1 plus 0.065 over 12 to the 86th power. Okay, that'll get you your answer. But if, 96? Oh yeah, I was just wanting to make sure that you saw that I could, it's so easy to make those mistakes, so I did one deliberately so that you could, okay, the hell with it. But you know what? I can get the same answer by doing it this. FV equals 2,500 times 1 plus 0.067 to the 8th power. It'll be a little off there because I'm rounding. The effective yield covers me on those compounding periods and number of periods. Both of those should give me the same, like same answer. This will be a little off because of the rounding here. But if you ran those, they should be almost the same result. To the dollars and cents, they might be the same. Let me quickly do this. I'm going to find my damn glass. Where the hell did I put my glass? There they are. Okay. 2,500 times 1 plus 0.065 divided by 12 raised to the 96th power is $4,199.17. If I do it this way, actually I'm kind of curious to see. I get slight difference, and that's that rounding error. Slight difference. What is that difference there? It's less than a buck. But that's what essentially what an effective yield tells you is the actual interest rate on an annualized basis that you're working with. You're going to see this again in a few different contexts in this class where I don't call it an effective yield, but what I do is a calculation that turns a number into an effective yield. So I don't have to talk about compounding periods and all that nonsense. I've just got a hard number. Here, 6.7% is what's actually going on an annual basis, not 6.5%. 6.7% is effectively what's happening. The 6.5%, you have to go through gyrations with dividing by 12 and putting 12 as part of the power. 6.7 just makes it simple. That's the actual real interest rate that's going on. The actual interest rate, let me not use real. A couple last things before I forget them. Make sure that you know what I mean by the word real in finance. Real. And I'm not talking about Scooby-Doo or keep it real. I'm talking about real in the sense of adjusted for inflation, before inflation. What is at the core in the absence of inflation premium? Okay? Make sure you know that term. It just sort of suddenly hit me. There's so many terms and nuances. It will not hurt you at all to just start writing out terms from your notes, from your memory, and with a couple of other people as your study partners, you can fill in gaps on each other's memory. And you'll find that there is a large number of terms by my count. And I go back every semester and I try to do a count. So far, more than 80 terms so far. More than 80 terms I have given you so far in this course. Just, I expect you to know all of them. By the way, make sure that you remember, I expect 2 decimal places of accuracy. Unless I say otherwise. So if it's a percentage, I want the percentage point 2 decimal places, 27.36%. No more, no less. Dollars and cents. Remember, I also expect your units to be there. Percentages, factor times, the time symbol, and dollars. I expect those to be part of your answers. And again, keep in mind, there is not any partial credit in the workout section. You get it or you don't get it. Because once you get out there, and I mean, I screw up all the time, and you do too on quizzes, and I cut a lot of slack there. I try to. Sometimes I'm more of a bitch than I should be. But when we get to the exams, that's live fire. Because when you get out there in the real world, it's not, oops, my bad, I just screwed you out of $2 million. It's, oops, my bad, can someone give me a job at McDonald's? What else do you have for me? Yeah.
You mentioned systematic risk.
Yeah. Is that diversifiable? No, that's non-diversifiable because that's part of the system. It's in the system. You can't cut it out. If you got a tumor in you, I can cut that out. But if your head is the tumor, I can't. I don't know what the hell that meant. What else? Yeah. 10K is the annual report of the corporation filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. It contains the audited financial statements for the fiscal year of the corporation. The 10Q is the quarterly statements containing the unaudited financial statements for the quarter. The 8K is the report on non-recurring events. It could be anything from a report to the SEC that we've done a press release to a report to the SEC that a director has died or that a new president, CEO has been selected. It is for those non-recurring events. The K's and Q's, as we call them, are periodic. They're just always going to happen. You know what they are. You know when they're going to happen. The 8K is for the random events that happen in every corporation's life. Things that, I mean, they can be all over the board. Some of them, I've not, quite honestly, I'll look at 8Ks and sometimes I wonder, why the hell did you tell the SEC about this? This is so trivial. But the whole idea there is caution is the advisory word. If it's
non-recurring, and if it has an impact on shareholders in any way, shape, or form, or on shareholder value, that's probably going to be the subject of an 8K. Okay? That's the nutshell. What else? Okay. Yeah. No, not quantitatively, but I could ask about it. It's fair game as a concept. I'm glad you brought that up because there are some of those things where I did some math, but I'm more interested in you knowing what that math meant. With a money multiplier, the required reserve ratio is coming through as a clearly powerful tool by which the money supply can be made to expand faster or at a slower rate. And it's all driven by that required reserve ratio. Now tell me this, just off the top of your head. Does the Federal Reserve use the required reserve ratio frequently as a tool of monetary policy or infrequently? You got a choice, just take a guess. No, infrequently. Remember, it's a meat axe tool. Remember how I described it as a blunt meat axe tool? It's not something that you use all the time. The most common tool of monetary policy is something else. You should know what the most common tool of monetary policy is. But something as blunt, if they change the required reserve ratio, that changes that multiplier, which changes literally the expansion path of the money supply. And that's blunt. Now, right now, remember what I said about that required reserve ratio? It's sort of a way by which we can signal confidence in the system, whether we think people are going to run on banks. Do you remember what I said the required reserve ratio right now is for low tranches of money in banks? Remember what I said? It's zero. There's no required reserve ratio for small tranches of money in banks right now. I don't know why it doesn't, but that should scare the hell out of me. That we're in a situation where essentially the money multiplier is going at it should be almost theoretically at an infinite rate on small tranches. But that's neither here nor there. Know the tools. Also, make sure you know the relative frequency with which those tools are used. And know where the word signaling comes in to this discussion. Where does that concept of signaling come in? Okay. Also, you should know who the players are, at least who the chairman of the Federal Reserve is now. You should know. If you don't, go up to Professor Trefsker's office on the third floor. I create demotivational posters at the Cheeseburger Network. You can go up there and see one of mine up there on his door. Professor Trefsker is on the third floor. Look at the picture. That's our current chairman. Look at what the current chairman is doing in that picture. It's downright creepy. And I caught the picture and I made it a demotivational poster. But anyway, go up there and have a look at that if you don't know who the chairman is. What else? Be sure that you know what I said in that article, by the way. That's fair game, what I wrote in that article. Fair game. I talked about the history of taxes and monetary policy. Anything else? Yeah.
Hey. Igor. Bring me the juice.
You want me to put it back up on the site? Yes, please. Yeah, it was one of the parts. I wrote a series called The Federal Reserve Under Fire. It was one of the parts of that. It's actually down in the sidebar. I'll just put a link to it up at the top. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.